Welcome once again to our program, Understanding the Bible, a Catholic approach to interpreting sacred scripture. Our guest once again is Ron Eldred, who is teacher of Bible and history, various histories, American history too, at John Paul II Catholic High. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, pastor emeritus at St. Patrick's here at 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock intersects the two streets. We've been talking about how we understand the Bible and all the background that a scholar and a commentator needs to know about trying to help us. We just started with criticisms or genres or analysis of the Old Testament. And now, Ron, we're looking at the genres or the literary forms. Is it history, poetry, prose, whatever it might be, found in the New Testament? So can you kind of give us a little brief summary of the different forms of writing, literary forms that are in the New Testament?
As with the Old Testament, we were using a list that Father Felix Just, a Jesuit scholar, a biblical scholar, had provided, and he has one for the New Testament as well. And the genres that we found in the New Testament, that we find in the New Testament, include Gospels. Gospels are proclamations of the good news. That's literally what, of course, Gospel means, from the Latin evangelium, about Jesus, so what he intended to establish the church, to strengthen people's faith in him. It's quasi-biographical, semi-historical portraits of the life, teachings, and actions of Jesus. We find this, of course, in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And Acts, there's one book of Acts in the New Testament. This form of a text is a partial narrative account about the beginnings and growth of the early Christianity. It's not a complete history by any means of the early church, since it focuses only on the actions of a few missionary leaders, such as St. Peter and St. Paul. About half of the Acts tells some of the missionary work of St. Peter, and about the other half tells...
Oh, really?
About
is it that closely divided?
Pretty close.
Yeah.
The missionary activity of St. Paul. And then letters, various letters. Sometimes these are called epistles. These are real letters addressing practical and theological issues relevant to particular communities. St. Paul wrote 14. We're not sure that he wrote all 14 of them, but at least he probably inspired all 14 of them. There's been questioned for centuries whether or not he actually wrote Hebrews. There are only seven or eight of them, I guess, that scholars are absolutely sure and full agreement pretty much across the board that he wrote. Nonetheless, he certainly inspired all of them. In fact, the course I teach on the Bible right now, we've been going through St. Paul's letters and looking at the various, not only the events that he describes, but also the themes, the theology of these epistles, because it's in these epistles that we find the doctrines of the church beginning to gradually emerge. Jesus, of course, you know, was not a theologian. He's God. It's his revelation. And a theologian comes along and reflects upon God's revelation and then begins to...
apply it to daily life.
Right.
This would be a good example, like Hebrews, which has always been... Who really wrote it, whether it was Paul or a disciple, but it would be where this criticism of this analysis comes in, trying to find out who really wrote something.
Yes.
That's where we get into this criticism, form criticism, except that we're talking about right now.
Yes.
I mean, a little bit ago.
There are other epistles other than Paul's epistles. Sometimes these are called the Catholic epistles. I've heard them by other names as well, but this would include St. Jude's epistle. Did he write it? We don't know for sure. Again, that's the kind of thing that a biblical scholar using these various techniques would try to discover.
But the church has included as an inspired work.
Yes, whoever wrote it. That's correct.
Okay.
And then St. James, his letters are just a very short little letter. I think if I recall right, it only has three chapters. But it's the book more than any other that deals with what's required from us in terms of works for our salvation.
It's a powerhouse.
Oh, yes, it certainly is. That three little chapters there really is a powerhouse.
Especially about the use of our tongue and the misuse of our tongue.
And then there's St. John. I think there's three letters, if I recall right, from St. John. There's been some question by historians or scripture scholars whether John really wrote them or not, or whether someone who was inspired by John wrote them. But like you said, it doesn't really matter in the final analysis because the church has declared that these were canonical, that is, they're inspired by the Holy Spirit, and of course we're required to...
And they certainly would have the thoughts of Paul or the thoughts of John.
Certainly they would. And then Peter, there's some letters from Peter and from some others as well. And then Father Just, he identifies some other types of genres. For example, one he calls church orders. These are types of documents or collections of instructions for the practical organization of religious communities. For example, 1 Timothy, written by St. Paul, and then Titus. What he calls a testament. These are documents that give a dying person's last wishes and instructions for his or her successors. 2 Timothy, for example, and 2 Peter. Homilies or sermons. This type of sermon cites and interprets older biblical text in reference to Jesus. He gives us an example, Hebrews, the book of Hebrews.
Refers a lot to the Old Testament.
Yes. But also the Hebrews, of course, in the New Testament as well, the book of Hebrews. Wisdom collection. This type is a collection of general instructions on how to live an ethical or Christian life, especially the book of James that we just mentioned a while ago. Even though it's just three little short chapters, it's packed full of all kinds of wise advice on how we should live our lives to get to heaven. And then what he calls encyclicals. This is a more formal type of a letter, and examples are circular letters intended for a broader audience. For example, 1 and 2 Peter, he gives us an example.
Now, I was surprised to use that word encyclicals because... Well, the only way I've run across it, and most Catholics, are the encyclicals that the popes write.
Sure, these are
special
basic
letters.
Yeah, special letters.
To the whole church. Okay, but it's the basic idea. It's a circular letter written to a group of people.
And, of course, last but not least, found in the New Testament are apocalypses. This genre is a vividly symbolic narrative that reveals God's views about a historical crisis in order to provide encouragement for a difficult present and hope for a better future. And, of course, the book of Revelation, which deals with things like the end times, is an example.
Ron, why is it important for us to be familiar with various biblical genres or literary forms? Does it influence how we interpret something and understand it?
I think it's important because we need to know the form or the genre of a text if we are to get the meaning from it that the author intended. I mean, he used that particular method, whether it be poetry or whatever it happened to be, for a purpose. And for example, the first 12 chapters of Genesis tells the truth of the creation and fall by using what some have called a mythological genre. But by mythological, myth is not something that's not true. That doesn't mean, we tend to in English, when we talk about a myth, we're talking about something that's not true. But that's not what we mean. It's a symbolic way of explaining something. Yet at the same time, it's trying to make a point. It's trying to make an historical point or a theological point.
So I liked your synonym there, symbolical.
Yes.
So symbolic way of something, just like the book of Revelation has so many symbols in it that aren't necessary literal to be interpreted literally.
Well, take Genesis. It was not intended to be an exact historical or scientific description of, you know, the things it describes, the creation and the fall and things like that. But it, but there was a creation and there was a fall and there was a redemption and all those things. You might say, in a way, the first 12 chapters of Genesis is sort of a poetic way of telling the story to a people, that something they could understand. But they didn't know about all this scientific stuff anyway. Today, if somebody were writing you know, Genesis, they might talk about the Big Bang Theory or something like that, but this was being written many centuries ago.
And it's, as you were stressing, it's not that it isn't a communication of truth, that man and woman rebelled against God at the instigation of Satan, and then they experienced this alienation from God that has come down to us through history. So it's a very beautiful way and memorable way of telling us a tremendous religious fact, that we are people who are in a fallen race and a fallen nature, and that's why we needed Jesus to come and restore us and to free us from this woundedness.
I think what could happen is that if you don't know the kind of things we're talking about right now, about genres, forms, that kind of thing, you can get all caught up in the story, but then fail to see the whole purpose of it, which you, of course, were just describing there.
Okay.
The truth of it.
Right. Well, and here, comment on this, because I've been in discussions with people before. I've said to them, look, if you want to believe the book of Genesis as a literal, historical interpretation, you can believe that, but you don't have to believe that as a Catholic.
Sure, there's nothing wrong with it. Even if a Catholic believes it, there's certainly nothing wrong with that. Like you said, they're free to do that. But as long as they get the point.
Right.
That's the...
If they understand why it was being written.
Sure.
To tell what
that
is
there was a creation, there was a fall, and of course there is a redemption. That's what salvation history is all about.
I just have to throw in a biblical joke here about Genesis, if I may. You know, they all, many of the artists and the like, I've even seen snakes with apples in their mouth being trampled on by the Blessed Mother. The child of hers would smash the head of the serpent. But we've always interpreted the account in Genesis about Adam and Eve eating of the forbidden tree, which was an apple tree. That's just a poetic description. But there's a statement that it's not the apple on the tree that caused the problem. It was the pear on the ground. And that people don't get that right away. Then suddenly they say, oh, I see, P-A-I-R.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go back to seriousness. Let's talk about the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses, and let's apply this, something we know about biblical analysis or biblical criticism from a Catholic viewpoint.
Yeah, I think this is one of the best ways to illustrate modern biblical criticism. Is to look at the Pentateuch and the first five books of the Old Testament to see how it's been, or at least aspects of it, has been interpreted. The Pentateuch, which we've spent a couple of sessions on earlier, Greek for five books or rolls, a lot of times were written in a scroll, codices. Consists of the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The Jews call it the Torah, or the Law. However, it contains more than the Law of God, for it also contains the story of the creation and the fall, as well as the formation of His chosen people, the Israelites. The Pentateuch includes the story of God's covenants with the patriarchs, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and then, of course, Moses and the oppressed Israelites in Egypt, beginning, of course, with Exodus. Also included is the story of the birth of the Israelites in the Sinai covenant and their journey to the edge of the Promised Land. Moreover, it includes the sayings of Moses. Now, the point is, For a long time, it was believed that Moses was the principal author of the Pentateuch. This seemed logical, since in Exodus 34:27-28, we find that God commanded him to write the words of the covenant on tablets of stone. And the book of Nehemiah says that when the Israelites returned from the Babylonian exile, the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had given to Israel, was read out in public. That's found in Nehemiah 8:1-8. We don't have time to go into the history of that, but this is after the Israelites had returned, or the Jews had returned from the Babylonian captivity. It probably occurred in about the year 530, through that period anyway, B.C. By the time of Jesus, these passages were interpreted to mean that Moses himself had written the Pentateuch. This is during Jesus' time now.
Okay.
Several places in the New Testament make reference to this fact. For example, Matthew 8:4, Mark 7:10, Luke 24:24, John 1:45 and 5:46, and we find it in the Acts 3:22, we find it in the Romans 10:5 and 19:1, Corinthians 9:9. There are a number of places where you find this reference that Moses basically wrote the Pentateuch. And from then on, both Christian and Jewish and Christian traditions assumed that Moses was the main author of the Pentateuch. But most modern biblical scholars for the last century or so believe that the composition of the first five books of the Bible is far more complex than this simple authorship. And what this research shows, and this is using, you know, the things that we talked about in an earlier session, form criticism, textual criticism, redaction criticism, and quite a few others. What their research shows is that the final editing, that's redaction, of course, the 5th century B.C. used materials from many different periods, some of them very ancient, and the arranged and rewritten text consisting of the first five books of the Bible was the version of the Bible that reached the Jews and Christians at the time of Jesus. And it is this version that is known as the Pentateuch. So what we're really saying here is that the Bible, the Pentateuch, the first five books, underwent quite a bit of writing and rewriting and over a period of many centuries. And simply was not written down from the first Genesis all the way down to the end of Deuteronomy by Moses.
Okay, so Moses would be around 1000 B.C.?
About 1250 to 1300 B.C.
Okay. So we're saying that by the 5th century, that'd be, let me say, 400 B.C., that it became pretty clear that it wasn't just from Moses himself, but he drew from a lot of different sources, and whoever put it together, using maybe some of Moses' material and the like, that it was considered to be, and we still call it, the Pentateuch, the Book of Moses.
Interestingly enough, it was the a priest by the name of Richard Simon, or Richard Simon, as we'd say in English, who was an oratorian priest, who was one of the very first to question the authorship of that Moses was the author of the first five books. And we're going to spend a part of a session on that later on, so I don't want to get into it too much right now. But an interesting thing, his main critic at the time was the famous, very saintly man, Boethius, which we have had occasion to quote in several of our series at various times. But we'll come back to that later. But he was, to my knowledge, he was the first one that brought into question the Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch.
Okay, and so we're not questioning, the scholars aren't questioning the inspiration of the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. They're questioning the author, who actually was historically the author.
Well, let's put it this way, Orthodox scholars.
Okay.
Unfortunately, there are a number of scholars that are not Orthodox. In fact, some of them aren't even believers, Protestant or Catholic. And some of these come to biblical scholarship with all kinds of presuppositions that we are going to spend a session on that too, so I
okay.
get into those presuppositions.
All right, what can you tell us about this text, the five books of Moses, how they were put together and rewritten and finally became what we have now as the Pentateuch?
Well, many scholars believe that the Pentateuch consists of four traditions blended together over a long period of time. Some scholars have identified the so-called Yahwist, Elohist, Priestly, and Deuteronomic strands that make up the first five books of the Bible. They're logically abbreviated as J, E, P, and D. I've seen some programs on TV, so like on the History Channel, about some of this stuff, so
okay.
Some of our readers, I'm sure, or our listeners have probably seen some of these programs. This approach is called the Graph of Wellhausen, or documentary hypothesis. In fact, there was a program not too long ago on this documentary hypothesis. It's named after a man of the K.H. Graf and Julius Wellhausen, or Wellhausen as they say in German. He was a German scholar. Both of them were 19th century German Lutheran biblical scholars. And most biblical scholars seem to follow some version of this hypothesis today. This hypothesis still provides the basis upon which more recent hypotheses are founded, and each tradition has its own theological viewpoint.
So as you mentioned before, some scholars are doing this to debunk and say that the scriptures really are not revelation from God. We can tell you where these things were drawn from, and it's really an attempt to pull the rug out from underneath belief in the inspired words of the Pentateuch.
In some instances, that's true.
And, of course, on the other hand, many scholars are just using it to say, well, we're trying to seek the truth where it may be found, and that it seems in this hypothesis that there are four different strands from which the Pentateuch or the five books of Moses were put together. Is that what we're saying?
Yes.
Okay, what can you tell us about this Yahwist, obviously referring to Yahweh, God, a name in the Old Testament?
Yeah, it just simply means I am who am, the way God identified himself to Moses in the burning bush at Mount Sinai. The Yahwist writers of the part of the Pentateuch, that part of the Pentateuch, use the name Yahweh to refer to God. It is translated to Lord, and is the same as the name by which God revealed himself, as I said, to the Israelites, and especially to Moses. The Yahwist tradition is concrete and employs many anthropomorphisms in its theological approach.
Well, you better say a word about anthropomorphism.
Yeah, by that I mean an interpretation of what is not human or personal in terms of human or personal characteristics. In other words, a humanization of God.
Okay.
And his deeds. And the Yahwist source dates from the period of about 950 B.C. in the southern kingdom of Judah and consists of half of Genesis and the first half of Exodus, plus fragments of Numbers. In other words, when you're reading this, if you're reading it in the original language, the words for God would be Yahweh or some form of that.
Okay.
On the other hand, when you get into some other places in the Genesis and the other books, they use the Elohim.
Okay. Well, let's go to the second one, the Elohist tradition, or you can pronounce it many ways, obviously.
The Elohist writer of the Pentateuch uses the name Elohim for God, and it means one of the great, one of great majesty or grandeur or power. And the word probably derives from El, which is a very common word for God in the Middle East back in those days, and among Semitic peoples, including the Israelites. And the Elohist part of the Pentateuch, they're more sober and moralistic than the Yahwist. Scholars believe that the Elohist source was composed around 850 B.C. and focuses on the northern kingdom of Israel. The Navarra Bible Commentary, which I have said many times, I think, in our series, is the best commentary, says that, quote, it may well be that when the northern kingdom fell to the Assyrians in the 9th century, Many Israelites fled south and brought with them their own interpreted traditions containing their theological content. End of quote. The Elohist narrative paralleled the Yahwist and make up about a third of Genesis and the first half of Exodus and a small part of Numbers. In other words, if you're reading this in the original language, which is Hebrew, and when you see the word God in Hebrew, it would either it would have a Elohim or some form of that. But in other places in Genesis, you see the word Yahwist used. So this led Wellhausen and other people like that to conclude that, well, there must have been different people writing different parts of this because they're using a different name for God in the original Hebrew language.
Okay. All right, let's go on. What about the priestly version, the third version of the Pentateuch, or the strand from which the five books were put together?
The Navarre Biblical Commentary on the Pentateuch states that the Babylonian exile of the Israelites in the 6th century B.C., quote, led to a period of deep religious soul-searching. The priests among the exiles had to try to keep the people's faith alive and to protect them from the influence of Babylonian religion, and was full of pagan myths and ritual practices. To do this, they kept reminding the people of the traditions of their ancestors, pointing out that the entire history of mankind, and particularly that of the people of Israel, involved a series of covenants made by God with men. The literary activity of these priestly groups in Babylon, which was kept up after the return from exile, is to be seen in elaborate collections of laws about worship, priestly purity, and the purity of the people. In modern scholarship, all this literary activity is described as belonging to the priestly tradition. In other words, it was written by priests.
Okay.
The priestly source contains detailed genealogies and is much more theologically oriented than the others. It deals primarily with the Jewish priesthood and matters of worship, as well as detailed lists of the Mosaic law. It is believed to have been written around 550 to 400 B.C., and it makes up about a fifth of Genesis, substantial portions of Exodus and Numbers, and almost all of Leviticus. So the point I'm trying to make here is that as you read, if you were reading this in the original languages, you would see a different approach.
Okay.
And so the ultimate point is that the Pentateuch was not simply written by one man, Moses, from the beginning to the end. It was actually written by different sources, such as the Elohist or the Yahwist tradition. And there may have been several writers.
Okay.
And several in the Yahwist tradition and several in this priestly tradition.
So our time is running out. Do you think you have time for the Deuteronomic source?
Well, the Navarre Biblical Commentary tells us that the, quote, the 7th century B.C. under Kings Hezekiah and Josiah saw profound religious changes which helped towards a new understanding of the past and brought about a literary revival. This, in turn, during and after the exile, led to the writing of a history of Israel from the conquest of the Promised Land onwards, found in the books of Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, and 1 and 2 Kings. This account is usually known as the Deuteronomic account because it included Deuteronomy, or part of it, as an introduction to the history narrated in these books. The Deuteronomic approach includes warnings, advice, and commands. In fact, a major part of the Deuteronomic theme is the idea that as long as the Israelites obeyed God's commandments, they would prosper, but if they broke it, they would be punished. I could say a lot about that, but I know we've run out of time.
Right. Okay, well, our time has run out on us, and we've been talking about how the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses, was put together, and of course the church has always declared that they are inspired books in the Bible. So may God bless you always and in all ways.
My soul, His love and His mercy.